When the USDA released its 2025 state-level data on farmland values, Oregon State University broke down the numbers and looked at land prices across the Beaver State. I recently sat down with OSU economist Dan Bigelow to take a look at the numbers, and we started our conversation taking a, I guess you could call it a 30,000-foot view of the overall trends in the Oregon farmland market.
Over the past, two plus decades, it's basically just been a steady upward march in the price of land in Oregon, regardless of how you look at it. There are little twists and turns here and there, little dips, but for the most part, land values, land prices, regardless of how you measure them, whether we're talking about, actual sales, or data from, say, USDA surveys, they continue to point in the same direction. And so that's kind of on the asset value side, right? If you think about the value of owning land itself, of course, there's a good chunk of land that's exchanged through rental markets. There, we see pretty much stable, flat rental rates from a, a big picture level where, after you take inflation into account, they really haven't changed all that much for 10, 15 years. So that points to, factors other than, say, agricultural production returns that are potentially driving this upward trend in land prices. If we're willing to think about, let's say, the income from the land that the landowner would get as being accurately measured by the cash rent, right? Which is probably true to some degree, but from a big picture level is probably on the mark. But that's, again, just kind of a big picture view.
Dan, when you break down the numbers, what's the biggest driver of land value moving higher here in Oregon?
Yeah, so that is one area where we're seeing outpaced growth for irrigated land, a higher rate of growth for irrigated land relative to non-irrigated land. So between, let's say, 2000 and 2025, if you look at irrigated land, on average around the state, we're basically talking about a doubling of the price per acre from about $6,000 an acre to, somewhere around $12,000 an acre now. When we look at non-irrigated land, the trend again is still upward, but we're talking about a change from $4,000 to $6,000 an acre. Again, this is over a 25-year period, so fairly long period. Now, irrigated land in general is going to command a higher return. You're going to be able to, earn more income from that land, grow things that, have a higher value of production. But the gap between irrigated and non-irrigated land prices, over the first decade of the 2000s was pretty stable, okay, a couple thousand dollars an acre. And then as we look, it seems like around 2012 or so, that gap really started to widen, and it's stayed that way since then, where the growth in irrigated land values is really, year on year outpacing that from non-irrigated land. And, this could be due to increased regulations on water rights becoming harder to come by, water scarcity becoming a factor that's increasingly on people's minds, and you know, in general, just the demand for land with good quality, you know, say senior water rights has gone up kind of in tandem with those trends.
So what kind of difference is there between irrigated acres and non-irrigated acres?
I think that's a really good question. It's hard to say exactly what happens to the land after it's sold. You know, a lot of land that might eventually be developed, you know, could be sort of a speculative purchase where it's going to remain in farm use for the short term, although that's not maybe in the long term plans of the new owner. You know, the one thing about Oregon, the funny thing is that we have this really comprehensive, unprecedented when you look around the country, comprehensive set of land use regulations that came about, you know, of course, with Senate Bill 100 in 1973. And we have, you know, on the whole, over the past several, you know, three, four decades, we've developed less land, you know, than say neighboring California and Washington, and then, you know, most other states around the country, right? So in a sense, you know, just again, with that back of the envelope calculation in mind, you could say that the program has been successful in conserving, you know, the farm and forest lands that it was intended to conserve. But at the same time, you know, population growth inside the state hasn't gone down. And, you know, urban growth boundaries were meant to be kind of adaptive, right, and expand over time to accommodate new housing needs. But, you know, at a high level, it seems like the expansion process itself hasn't maybe worked as smoothly as many people had hoped, or as some people had hoped, you know, depending on what hat you're wearing. But as a result of that, you know, we have this kind of push by Governor Kotek and her administration to kind of build a lot more housing now, right? We do have a housing shortage in the state, and how that's met is ultimately going to shape what happens to a lot of the farmland in the periphery of urban areas. But one, you know, on the land market side, one thing I did notice is that, you know, if you look at, say, land that's within a half mile of the nearest urban growth boundary, that's selling right now on average for about $16,000 an acre. Whereas if you look at land that's, say, 2 to 4 miles away, that's more like $8,000 an acre, right? So about half of that. And that premium attributable to being closer to the urban growth boundary has gone up, has gone up in recent times, right? So if you compared the last, say, 5 years of the 2010s to the most recent 5 years, the price of that land that's closest to the urban growth boundary is up by, you know, $3,000-$4,000 an acre. And looking kind of at a longer historical view, this is the highest price for that land in close proximity to urban growth boundaries since the early 2000s, the housing crisis that brought on the Great Recession, right, where, you know, loans were being given out to everyone to buy a house. And there was, you know, this huge uptick in building around the country. So, yeah, it's a tricky question, especially when we're talking about here in Oregon, because you can't just buy land and develop it at an urban density, right? you can't just buy EFU land and immediately convert it. There are exempt uses, exemptions from the EFU rules that exclusive EFU is exclusive farm use, from the EFU rules that allow, you know, additional uses to take place on that land, but that's not the same thing as, say, building a, you know, a full-fledged housing development.
You know, it's something we hear on the national side of things, Dan, is foreign ownership of agricultural land across the country. How prevalent is foreign ownership of farmland across Oregon?
This is, yeah, as you mentioned, this is something that gets a lot of attention, you know, in D.C. and here in Salem. But so, you know, the only real information we get on that is from a USDA program called AFIDA. That's the acronym, the Agricultural Foreign Investment Disclosure Act, where foreign agents who purchase real estate are required to report their holdings to the USDA, right? And now, you know, I want to, of course, mention that there has been some concern in the past that other people have written about, you know, how accurate these numbers really are. If you're a really savvy, say, foreign investor, and for whatever reason, you want to hide the fact that you own land in Oregon or, you know, wherever around the country, there are probably, you know, different loopholes and shell company type setups, limited liability companies that you could use to kind of obscure your holdings and then, you know, potentially not report them. But, you know, with that said, what the numbers for Oregon suggest are that we've got basically 1.3 total acres of farm and forest land owned by foreign investors. Farmland, if you count the both cropland and pasture land categories, it's like 210,000 acres. Okay, from 2023, the most recent numbers we have on this. So if you take it as a percentage of the total farmland in the state, you know, it's something like 1.5% that's officially being recorded as being owned by foreign investors. The investors for farmland tend to be various European countries. You know, there's not really one that's driving the entire trend there. Whereas, of course, you know, not surprisingly for forest land, which again makes up the lion's share of that recorded foreign ownership, that's largely Canadian investors, right? Which, you know, is kind of what you would expect given the kind of interconnectedness of the timber industry across the border.
So as you look back on the last, let's say, 10, 15 years or so, what are your thoughts on farmland prices in Oregon? And maybe what do you see going into the future?
Yeah, so over the, you know, the, say, recent history, land has increasingly been viewed, I think, as an important investment asset for people outside of, you know, people who aren't involved day to day in the farm and forest sectors. And, you know, that's largely because it tends to hold its value over the long run, right? And so it can kind of act as a hedge or a buffer against broader macroeconomic fluctuations, right? You're not going to get rich overnight from buying land, of course, but over the long haul, it's a durable asset. It's non-depreciable. It's inherently scarce. We're not making any more of it. You hear that often. And as a result, its value just kind of continues to go up. Whereas, you're not going to, if a stock goes bust, you could lose your money overnight potentially, right? But that's not the case with land. And so that seems to be the biggest shift in terms of kind of outside pressure on this particular market. And, one of the ways to think about this too is kind of going back to what I mentioned before, where we're seeing basically flat rents, but increasing land prices, right? So that kind of suggests that, people are buying land for what they expect it to return in the future, right? Whether that's from keeping it in farm use or from doing something else with it, right? With whether it's, one thing I haven't mentioned is energy development, right? Which again is not going to affect the lion's share of land in the state or anything like that, but it is something that people bring up as a concern. It suggests that the returns that you would get from producing on that land aren't sufficient to justify purchasing of it, right? Like the turnover period, say, if you wanted to buy land, use it to produce a crop, how long would it take for you to recoup that initial investment has gotten, kind of longer and longer in a lot of places, right? So the annual return right now is something like 2-3.5%, depending on whether we're talking about irrigated or non-irrigated land, which, is below, say, the current treasury yield, which people often view as, a safe, risk-free investment, right? So if that were all you were doing with the land, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you just park your money in treasuries instead and make an additional percentage of, 1% return? So it suggests that there is some other driver that's kind of affecting the way the market has evolved over the last decade or so.
What areas have you seen land values go up the most?
Kind of more or less what we talked about before with irrigated, non-irrigated land. Deschutes County has extremely high land prices. So when we look around the state, the highest land prices tend to be around the Portland metro area, and also in Deschutes County, right? Where obviously Bend has grown rapidly, especially since the pandemic, but over the last 10, 15 years as well. And then also Hood River, right? Where Hood River is, it's fairly close to Portland, so there's probably some proximity effect going on there. You also got obviously really high value amenities in Hood River County, but then you also have productive orchards that generally are going to command a higher agriculture-related return, farm-related return than other places.
Once again, Oregon State University's Dan Bigelow.